For NPR Music, it's the All Songs Considered Plus One podcast. I'm Robin Hilton. And right now you're asking yourself, why, oh why, are we playing Hootie and the Blowfish? Well, this week we were shocked, to learn that the mail order music company Columbia House has filed for bankruptcy. And most of us were shocked because nobody really knew the company was still in business. The key word is it was a mail order company. But for anyone who loved music, bought music back in the 80s and 90s, Columbia House was a huge, hugely important part of your life. The deals varied, but basically they'd give you a bunch of music, like 8 or 9 CDs for free or for a penny, and they'd mail them to you, and in exchange you'd agree to buy 2 more albums at the quote-unquote regular price. I'm doing air quotes now, regular price.
You can't see the air quotes at home.
And that's NPR Music's Stephen Thompson here in D.C. with me, and we've got NPR Music's Peter Orlov in New York. Hey, guys.
Hello, hello.
So, you know, the Columbia House would give you a couple of years to fulfill this obligation. I was a repeat user. Oh, boy. I was a repeat user of Columbia House, and this cracked rearview mirror record from Hootie and the Blowfish was one that I ended up with through Columbia House. Let's lose that. So, Peter, you actually worked for Columbia House back in the 90s. How is it that I and so many people ended up with Hootie and the Blowfish from Columbia House?
Well, there's multiple answers to that. I think that they sold so many copies of Hootie and the Blowfish because Hootie and the Blowfish was a selection of the month.
Mm. And what did that mean, a selection of the month?
So selection of the month was sort of the record that they foisted upon you if you did not send in your card in a timely manner saying, I don't want to buy any records right now. Mm. Robin, as you said, you know, you had anywhere from 2 to 3 years to fulfill your contractual obligations with Columbia House. And once every 3 to 4 weeks, you would receive a catalog with a selection of the month. Now, quite a lot of people received the catalog with Hootie and the Blowfish as the selection of the month. And it was, if I remember correctly, a very, very popular selection of the month. So that means a lot of people chose to buy Hootie and the Blowfish.
I think a lot of people in general chose to buy Hootie and the Blowfish.
They sold 10 million copies in the first year of this record. I think a third of them came from Columbia House.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. So one of the reasons why they made themselves and Columbia House helped make them was when a record started getting huge. You know, Columbia House was one of the main advertisers in popular culture magazines at that time. So, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish starts popping up, and Columbia House advertisements with Hootie and the Blowfish start popping up, and it begins to be like a self-perpetuating sales. I mean, there's very, very few of those diamond-size records that were not attributed to a Michael Jackson or a Prince from that period that did not benefit from having a Columbia House marketing / advertising campaign and then sending it out to all of its members, you know. The other big one I remember from the time was also an Atlantic Records release, which was the Matchbox 20.
Yeah, I guess that's, you know, one of my questions is, you know, chicken and the egg. I mean, were those selection of the month club choices, were those bought and paid for? Was that a way that Columbia House made a lot of money? Was a record label would say, make Hootie and the Blowfish, you know, this hot new artist, the selection, or did that derive from fan demand?
So Columbia House was owned partly by Warner Music Group and partly by Sony Records. So it's not like somebody went into a meeting and said, hey, our fourth quarter, you know, priority is Hootie and the Blowfish. But, you know, it didn't hurt.
Right.
So that's one layer of this. The other layer of this is that the Columbia House business model allowed for Columbia House to manufacture its own records. All of us who were members, and I was a member multiple times as well, under various names, everybody will remember that a Columbia House release, whether it was an LP or a cassette or a CD, rather than having a barcode on the back, it said manufactured in Terre Haute, Indiana by the Columbia House Record and Tape and CD Club or whatever. And so what you had was essentially a limitless press. And when something was taking off, they could just manufacture Cracked Rear View or the No Doubt record.
Bringing Down the Horse.
Or whatever. Yeah, all those things, they would just get manufactured over and over and over and over. So it was a self-perpetuating thing. And, you know, and then the radio would play it and more people would want it. And there was 12 for a Penny in your Rolling Stone or in your People magazine. So these things kept going and going and going and going of their own volition. But Columbia House and their advertising and their promotion was definitely part of the fuel for the fire.
Yeah, you mentioned that these things started with little flyers and magazines. And just to paint a picture for if you weren't buying music back then, or if you're only 15 or 20 years old and don't know this, Rolling Stone, other magazines would have these little pullout things. It had little pictures of CDs on them, these long list of CDs, about maybe 100, 200 records, whatever. And you would literally put a little checkbox, make a little mark by the one that you wanted, and you'd mail that in. Sometime later, you'd get all these CDs. And of course, you also had just signed your life away. And as Peter alluded to, using different names, people like me and all the other kids who had no money and we were just trying to build this massive collection of music would use different names, right, or send them to different addresses. Or there was the competitor, was it BMG?
BMG.
We'd play them against each other, right, where I'd do this one and stagger them. So, well, now I'm a member of BMG and I'll let that expire and then I'll rejoin Columbia House. And, you know, I was always trying to beat the system. And I and everybody else was always trying to beat the system. And Steven somehow, you know, like I was the target market, right? I really thought I was getting away with something. But somehow, Steven, you didn't. You were a huge music fan back then and you didn't join Columbia House.
No, see, this is how you are the target market and I wasn't. You're dumber than I am. No, my parents filled my head. I fell in love with music throughout the 1980s. So, you know, I graduated from high school in 1990. And so I spent all of junior high and high school using the flyers for Columbia House and BMG as like a virtual record store. You know, the nearest record store, I would ride my bike to Waupaca, Wisconsin, 13 miles away, in order to thumb through records.
Right.
And those little catalogs were like a virtual record store. You know, you were almost flipping through. You'd see those tiny little thumbnail size album covers. But my parents had filled my head with, like, you know, my parents are skeptics, you know? So, you know, they were like, you know, here, read this book. It's called How to Lie with Statistics. You know, they were always just like, read the fine print. And you know, I didn't have, you know, I had jobs and stuff. I had a paper route and then I worked in a grocery store. I could have paid for records that way, but they were just always like, if it looks too good to be true, it's too good to be true, you're never going to get out of that contract. You know, I've always looked at those things as like, well, that's baby's first mail fraud, you know. that's my first opportunity to get in really big trouble.
Did you get the little catalogs and go through and check all the ones if you were had been allowed?
I would live vicariously through other people's mail fraud.
You were like the were you like the kid who had to stay inside and practice the violin while all your friends?
Yeah, it's kind of like going to bed at 7, you know, like shutting the curtain and you see your friends playing outside. I just didn't do it. And plus, the other thing is like I was raised by collectors. My parents, my mother still is a comic book collector. You wanted the best of the thing that you coveted. So I was a music fan and I was starting a music collection. I wanted the album art. I wanted, like, if I bought a cassette, I wanted the J card that like folds out and it's this lustrous, you know, collection of photographs and lyrics and stuff. And that Columbia House stuff was like a blank J card that was just white inside. Mm-hmm. The CDs would just have like a sheet of paper, you know, with the album cover on it.
Yeah, that's what Peter was saying.
What Peter was saying about how they manufactured it more cheaply. And
to me,
it was the equivalent of like going to one of those like really low rent traveling carnivals where they're selling cassettes and they're clearly bootlegs.
Right.
They felt like bootlegs to me, and so I didn't want them.
Did anyone see writing on the wall with this at the time? Do you think
quite a few people? I mean, the very, very advent of the web as a different way of doing business as opposed to through the mail in terms of getting the catalogs. You know, one of the reasons why they, you know, the joke is, I can't believe they've lasted this long.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons they lasted this long is because once the bottom dropped out of the CD business, their DVD business did really, really well, and they sort of ran it through the website. And for a little while, I think that the Columbia House DVD Club was one of the most popular web destinations out there in like the early aughts.
I think we've shed so many tears over the loss of real... No, I mean, seriously, we've shed a lot of tears over the loss of record stores as the music landscape has changed. And I'm wondering if this deserves our tears as well, Stephen.
No.
I would agree. I would agree.
It's the end of an era.
It is, but not all ends of eras are sad times. I mean, this was just another way to consume physical products that is taking up a lot of landfill space right now.
Yeah, well said. I can't imagine. Like, I miss record store listening parties. I miss conversations with record store clerks. a lot of what we lament that has been lost in past ways of getting music is about warmth and contact. This was not warmth and contact. I do think it's a marking of the passage of time. It is the death of something that we experienced as kids that always gives us a nostalgic pang. But no, I will shed tears for other things, not this.
And I would like to add just one thing, that the group of people that worked at Columbia House was an incredible, incredible group. I mean, there were art directors who I still see, whose work I still see. There were writers who every single one of our listeners has been reading for many, many years in popular magazines. Some of the best known music critics, popular pop music critics in the land were copywriters at Columbia House. Some authors of incredible books were people who worked at Columbia House. And as a depository of some incredible young talent, myself not included.
and also
In New York City, in the late 90s, it was a kind of awesome place to work in. And I still love those people. And otherwise, sayonara.
Well, as I reminisce about my relationship with Columbia House.
So open up your morning light, say a little prayer for
I think about how it fueled my Lilith Fair phase all through the 90s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We sold a lot of Sarah McLachlan records. Oh, yes.
And this Paula Cole one, too, I bet. Thanks, guys, for joining us. We raise a glass to the Columbia House.
Sure.
Mail order music and video company filed for bankruptcy this week, and wish them the best of luck. Apparently, there are already some buyers lining up to pick it up.
Well, you know, it's available cheap.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Stephen. For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered's Plus One podcast. I'm Robin Hilton.
All good?
I got something in my eye.